What conclusions do you draw, Miss Powell? The judge said. Two different parties are searching the lease territories for the same book, Miss Powell said. She did not have to state that the target of this search was probably the book stolen from the gentleman named Hackworth. Can you speculate as to the identity of these parties? Miss Powell said, Of course, neither device carries a maker's mark. The bat-eared one has Dr. X written all over it. Most of its features appear to be evolved, not engineered, and the doctor's flea circus is nothing more than an effort to collect evolved mites with useful features. At a first glance, the other device could have come from any of the engineering works associated with major files, Nippon, New Atlantis, Hindustan, the First Distributed Republic being prime suspects. But on deeper examination, I find a level of elegance.
Elegance?
Pardon me, Your Honor. The concept is not easy to explain. There is an ineffable quality to some technology, described by its creators as consinitus, or technically sweet, or a nice hack, signs that it was made with great care by one who was not merely motivated, but inspired. It is the difference between an engineer and a hacker.
Or an engineer and an artifex, Judge Fang said.
A trace of a smile came across Miss Powell's face.
I fear that I have enmeshed that little girl in a much deeper business than I ever imagined, Judge Fang said.
He rolled up the paper and handed it back to Miss Powell. Chang set the judge's teacup back in front of him and poured more tea. Without thinking about it, the judge put his thumb and fingertips together and tapped them lightly against the tabletop several times. This was an ancient gesture in China. The story was that one of the early emperors liked to dress as a commoner and travel about the Middle Kingdom to see how the peasants were getting along. Frequently, as he and his staff were sitting about the table in some inn, he would pour tea for everyone. They could not kowtow to their lord without giving away his identity, so they would make this gesture using their hand to imitate the act of kneeling. Now Chinese people used it to thank each other at the dinner table. From time to time, Judge Fang caught himself doing it, and thought about what a peculiar thing it was to be Chinese in a world without an emperor. He sat, hands folded into sleeves, and thought about this and other issues for several minutes, watching the vapor rise from his tea and form into a fog as it condensed round the bodies of micro-aerostats.
Soon we will obtrude upon Mr. Hackworth and Dr. X, and learn more by observing their reactions. I will consider the right way to set about this. In the meantime, let us concern ourselves with the girl. Chang, visit her apartment building to see whether there's been any trouble there. Suspicious characters hanging about.
Sir, with all respect, everyone who lives in the girl's building is a suspicious character.
You know what I mean, said the judge with some asperity. The building should have a system for filtering nanocytes from the air. If this system is working properly, and if the girl does not take the book out of her building, then she should go unnoticed by these.
The judge drew a streak through the dust on the book's cover and smeared the toner between his fingers.
Speak with the landlord of her building, and let him know that his air filtering system is due for an inspection, and that this is genuine, not just a solicitation for a bribe.
Yes, sir, Chang said.
He pushed his chair back, rose, bowed, and strode out of the restaurant, pausing only to extract a toothpick from the dispenser by the exit. It would have been acceptable for him to finish his lunch, but Chang had, in the past, evinced concern for the girl's welfare and apparently wanted to waste no time.
Miss Powell, plant recording surveillance devices in the girl's flat. At first, we will change and review the tapes every day. If the book is not detected soon, we will begin changing them every week.
Yes, sir, Miss Powell said.
She slipped on her phenomenoscopic spectacles. Colored light reflected from the surfaces of her eyes as she lost herself in some kind of interface. Judge Fang refilled his tea, cupped it in the palm of his hand, and went for a stroll round the edge of the terrace. He had much more important things to think about than this girl and her book, but he suspected that from now on he would be thinking about little else.
Description of Old Shanghai. Situation of the Theatre Parnasse. Miranda's Occupation.
Before the Europeans got their hooks into it, Shanghai had been a walled village on the Huangpu River, a few miles south of its confluence with the estuary of the Yangtze. Much of the architecture was very sophisticated Ming Dynasty stuff, private gardens for rich families, a shopping street here and there concealing interior slums,
a rickety, vertiginous tea house rising from an island in the center of a pond. More recently, the wall had been torn down and a sort of beltway built on its foundations. The old French concession wrapped around the north side, and in that neighborhood, on a corner looking across the ring road into the old city, the Theatre Parnasse had been constructed during the late 1800s. Miranda had been working there for 5 years, but the experience had been so intense that it often seemed more like 5 days. The Parnasse had been built by Europeans back when they were serious and unapologetic about their Europeanness. The facade was classical, a three-quarter round portico on the street corner, supported by Corinthian columns, all done in white limestone. The portico was belted by a right mappue, built in 1890, outlined by tubes of purple and pink neon. It would have been easy enough to tear it off and replace it with something mediatronic, but they enjoyed hauling the bamboo ladders out from the set shop and snapping the black plastic letters into place, advertising whatever they were doing tonight. Sometimes they would lower the big mediatronic screen and show movies, and Westerners would come from all over Greater Shanghai, dressed up in their tuxedos and evening gowns, and sit in the dark watching Casablanca or Dances with Wolves. And at least twice a month, the Parnasse Company would actually get out on stage and do it. Become actors, rather than rectors, for a night. Lights and grease paint and costumes. The hard part was indoctrinating the audience. Unless they were theater buffs, they always wanted to run up on stage and interact, which upset the whole thing. Live theater was an ancient and peculiar taste, roughly on par with listening to Gregorian chants, and it didn't pay the bills. They paid the bills with ractives. The building was tall and narrow, making the most of precious Shanghai real estate, so the proscenium had a nearly square aspect ratio, like an old-fashioned television. Above it was the bust of some forgotten French actress, supported on gilt wings, flanked by angels brandishing trumpets and laurel wreaths. The ceiling was a circular fresco depicting muses disporting themselves in flimsy robes. A chandelier hung from the center. Its incandescent bulbs had been replaced by new things that didn't burn out, and now it cast light evenly onto the rows of tiny, creaking seats closely packed together on the main floor. There were three balconies and three stories of private boxes, two on the left side and two on the right side of each level. The fronts of the boxes and balconies were all painted with tableaux from classical mythology, the predominant color there, as elsewhere, being a highly French robin's egg blue. The theater was crammed with plasterwork, so that the faces of cherubs, overwrought Roman gods, impassioned Trojans and such were always poking out of columns and soffits and cornices, catching you by surprise. Much of this work was spalled from bullets fired by high-spirited Red Guards during Cultural Revolution times. Other than the bullet holes, the Parnasse was in decent shape, though sometime in the 20th century, great black iron pipes had been anchored vertically alongside the boxes and horizontally before the balconies, so that spotlights could be bolted on. Nowadays, the spotlights were coin-sized discs, phased array devices that carried their own batteries, and could be stuck up anywhere and controlled by radio. But the pipes were still there, and always required a lot of explaining when tourists came through. Each of the 12 boxes had its own door and a curtain rail curving around the front so that the occupants could get some privacy between acts. They'd mothballed the curtains and replaced them with removable soundproof screens, unbolted the seats, and stored them in the basement. Now each box was a private, egg-shaped room, just the right size to serve as a body stage. These 12 stages generated 75% of the cash flow of the Theatre Parnasse. Miranda always checked into her stage half an hour early to run a diagnostic on her chat grid. The sights didn't last forever. Static electricity or cosmic rays could knock them out. And if you let your instrument go to pot out of sheer laziness, you didn't deserve to call yourself a rector. Miranda had decorated the dead walls of her own stage with posters and photos of role models, largely actresses from 20th century passives. She had a chair in the corner for roles that involved sitting down. There was also a tiny coffee table where she set down her triple latte, a 2-liter bottle of mineral water, and a box of throat lozenges. Then she peeled down to a black leotard and tights, hanging her street clothes on the tree by the door. Another rector might have gone nude, worn street clothes, or tried to match her costume to the role she'd be playing if she were lucky enough to know in advance. At the moment, though, Miranda never knew.
She had standing bids on Kate in the Rackative version of Taming of the Shrew, which was a butcherous kludge, but popular among a certain sort of male user. Scarlett O'Hara in the Rackative Gone with the Wind. A double agent named Ilsa in an espionage thriller set on a train passing through Nazi Germany. And Rhea, a neo-Victorian damsel in distress in Silk Road, an adventure comedy romance Rackative set on the wrong side of contemporary Shanghai. She created that role. After the good review had come in, a remarkably realistic portrayal by newcomer Miranda Redpath. She had played little else for a couple of months, even though her bid was so steep that most users opted for one of the understudies or contented themselves with watching passively for one-tenth the price. But the distributor had botched the PR targeting when they tried to take it beyond the Shanghai market, and so now Silk Road was in limbo while various heads rolled. Four leading roles was about as many as she could keep in her head at once. The prompter made it possible to play any role without having seen it before, if you didn't mind making an ass of yourself. But Miranda had a reputation now, and couldn't get away with shoddy work. To fill in the blanks when things got slow, she also had standing bids under another name for easier work, mostly narration jobs, plus anything having to do with children's media. She didn't have any kids of her own, but she still corresponded with the ones she'd taken care of during her governess days. She loved acting with children, and besides, it was good exercise for the voice, saying those silly little rhymes just right. "Practice Kate from Shrew," she said. And the Miranda-shaped constellation was replaced by a dark-haired woman with green, feline eyes, dressed in some costume designer's concept of what a rich woman in the Italian Renaissance would be likely to wear. Miranda had large bunny eyes, while Kate had cat eyes, and cat eyes were used differently from bunny eyes, especially when delivering a slashing witticism. Carl Hollywood, the company's founder and dramaturge, who'd been sitting in passively on her shrews, had suggested that she needed more work in this area. Not many payers enjoyed Shakespeare or even knew who he was, but the ones who did tended to be very high on the income scale and worth catering to. Usually this kind of argument had no effect on Miranda, but she'd been finding that some of these rich, sexist, snob, asshole gentlemen were remarkably good actors. And any professional could tell you that it was a rare pleasure to act with a payer who knew what he was doing. The shift comprised the prime times for London, the East Coast, and the West Coast. In Greenwich time, it started around 9 p.m., when Londoners were finishing dinner and looking for entertainment, and wound up about 7 a.m., when Californians were going to bed. No matter what time zones they actually lived in, all actors tried to work during those hours. In Shanghai's time zone, the shift ran from about 5 a.m. to mid-afternoon, and Miranda didn't mind doing overtime if some well-heeled Californian wanted to stretch a Rackative late into the night. Some of the actors in her company didn't come in until later in the day, but Miranda still had dreams of living in London and craved attention from that city's sophisticated payers, so she always came to work early. When she finished her warm-ups and went on, she found a bid already waiting for her. The casting agent, which was a semi-autonomous piece of software, had assembled a company of 9 payers, enough to act all the guest roles in First Class to Geneva, which was about intrigue among rich people on a train in Nazi-occupied France, and which was to Rackatives what the mousetrap was to passive theater. It was an ensemble piece, 9 guest roles to be assumed by payers, 3 somewhat larger and more glamorous toast roles to be assumed by payees like Miranda. One of the characters was, unbeknownst to the others, an Allied spy. Another was a secret colonel in the SS. Another was secretly Jewish. Another was a Cheka agent. Sometimes there was a German trying to defect to the Allied side, but you never knew which was which when the Rackative started up. The computer switched all the roles around at random. It paid well because of the high payer-payee ratio. Miranda provisionally accepted the bid. One of the other host roles hadn't been filled yet, so while she waited, she bid and won a filler job. The computer morphed her into the face of an adorable young woman whose face and hair looked typical of what was current in London at the moment. She wore the uniform of a British Airways ticket agent. "Good evening, Mr. Ormland," she gushed, reading the prompter. The computer dipped it into an even perkier voice and made subtle corrections in her accent.
"Good evening, Margaret," said the jowly Brit,
staring out of a pane on her mediatron. He was wearing half glasses, had to squint to make out her name tag. His tie was loose on his chest, a gin and tonic in one hairy fist, and he liked the looks of this Margaret. Which was almost guaranteed, since Margaret had been morphed up by a marketing computer in London that knew more about this gentleman's taste in girl flesh than he would like to think.
6 months without a vacation. How boring, Miranda, Margaret said. You must be doing something terribly important, she continued, facetious without being mean, the two of them sharing a little joke.
Yes, I suppose even making lots of money does become boring after a while, the man returned in much the same tone.
Miranda glanced over at the casting sheet for First Class to Geneva. She'd be pissed if this Mr. Ormland got overly talkative and forced her to pass on the bigger role, though he did seem a reasonably clever sort.
You know, it's a fine time to visit Atlantan, West Africa, and the airship Gold Coast is scheduled to depart in 2 weeks. Shall I book a stateroom for you? And a companion, perhaps?
Mr. Ormland seemed iffy.
Call me old-fashioned, he said, but when you say Africa, I think AIDS and parasites.
Oh, not in West Africa, sir, not in the new colonies. Would you like a quick tour?
Mr. Ormland gave Miranda Margaret one long, searching, horny look, sighed, checked his watch, and seemed to remember that she was an imaginary being.
Thank you just the same, he said, and cut her off.
Just in time, too. The playbill for Geneva had just filled up. Miranda only had a few seconds to switch contexts and get herself into the character of Ilsa before she found herself sitting in a first-class coach of a mid-20th-century passenger train, staring into the mirror at a blonde, blue-eyed, high-cheekboned ice queen. Unfolded on her dressing table was a letter written in Yiddish. So tonight she was the secret Jew. She tore the letter into tiny pieces and fed them out of her window, then did the same with a couple of stars of David that she'd rooted out of her jewelry case. This thing was fully reactive, and there was nothing to prevent other characters from breaking into her coach and going through her possessions. Then she finished putting on her makeup and choosing her outfit and went to the dining car for dinner. Most of the other characters were already in here. The nine amateurs were stiff and stilted as usual. The two other professionals were circulating among them, trying to loosen them up, break through that self-consciousness, and get them into their characters. Geneva ended up dragging on for a good 3 hours. It was nearly ruined by one of the payers, who had clearly signed up exclusively for the purpose of maneuvering Ilsa into bed. He turned out to be the secret SS colonel, too, but he was so hell-bent on fucking Ilsa that he spent the whole evening out of character. Finally, Miranda lured him into the kitchen in the back of the dining car, shoved a foot-long butcher knife into his chest, and left him in the fridge. She had played this role a couple of hundred times and knew the location of every potentially lethal object on the train. After a reactive, it was considered good form to go to the green room, a virtual pub, where you could chat out of character with the other raptors. Miranda skipped it, because she knew that the creep would be waiting for her there. Next was a lull of an hour or so. Prime time in London was over, and New Yorkers were still eating dinner. Miranda went to the bathroom, ate a little snack, and picked up a few kiddie jobs. Kids on the West Coast were getting back from school and jumping right into the high-priced educational raptives that their parents made available to them. These things created a plethora of extremely short but fun roles. In quick succession, Miranda's face was morphed into a duck, a bunny, a talking tree, the eternally elusive Carmen Sandiego, and the repulsively cloying Doogie the dinosaur. Each of them got a couple of lines at most.
That's right. B stands for balloon. I like to play with balloons, don't you, Matthew?
Sound it out, Victoria. You can do it.
Soldier ants have larger and stronger jaws than their worker counterparts and play a key role in defending the nest from predators.
Please don't throw me into that briar patch, Brer Fox.
Hello, Roberta. I've been missing you all day. How was your field trip to Disneyland?
20th-century airships were filled with flammable hydrogen, expensive helium, or inefficient hot air, but our modern versions are filled literally with nothing at all. High-strength nanostructures make it possible to pump all the air from an airship's envelope and fill it with a vacuum. Have you ever been on an airship, Thomas?
Nell's further experiences with the Primer. The origin of Princess Nell.
Once upon a time, there was a little princess named Nell who was imprisoned in a tall, dark castle on an island.
Why?
Nell and Harv had been locked up in the dark castle by their evil stepmother.
Why didn't their father let them out of the dark castle?
Their father, who had protected them from the whims of the wicked stepmother, had gone sailing over the sea and never come back.
Why did he never come back?
Their father was a fisherman. He went out in his boat every day. The sea is a vast and dangerous place, filled with monsters, storms, and other dangers. No one knows what fate befell him. Perhaps it was foolish of him to sail into such danger, but Nell knew better than to fret over things she could not change.
Why did she have a wicked stepmother?
Nell's mother died one night when a monster came out of the sea and entered their cottage to snatch Nell and Harv, who were just babies. She fought with the monster and slew it, but in doing so suffered grievous wounds and died the next day, with her adopted children still nestled in her bosom.
Why did the monster come from the sea?
For many years, Nell's father and mother badly wanted children, but were not so blessed, until one day when the father caught a mermaid in his net. The mermaid said that if he would let her go, she would grant him a wish, so he wished for two children, a boy and a girl. The next day, while he was out fishing, he was approached by a mermaid carrying a basket. In the basket were the two little babies, just as he had requested, wrapped up in cloth of gold. The mermaid cautioned him that he and his wife should not allow the babies to cry at night.
Why were they in gold cloth?
They were actually a princess and a prince who had been in a shipwreck. The ship sank, but the basket containing the two babies bobbed like a cork on the ocean until the mermaids came and found them. They took care of those two babies until they found a good parent for them. He took the babies back to the cottage and presented them to his wife, who swooned for joy. They lived happily together for some time, and whenever one of the babies cried, one of the parents would get up and comfort it. But one night, Father did not come home, because a storm had pushed his little red fishing boat far out to sea. One of the babies began to cry, and the mother got up to comfort it. But when the other began to cry as well, there was nothing she could do, and shortly the monster came calling. When the fisherman returned home the next day, he found his wife's body lying beside that of the monster, and both of the babies unharmed. His grief was very great, and he began the difficult task of raising both the children. One day, a stranger came to his door. She said that she had been cast out by the cruel kings and queens of the land beyond, and that she needed a place to sleep, and would do any kind of work in exchange. At first she slept on the floor, and cooked and cleaned for the fishermen all day long, but as Nell and Harv got bigger, she began to give them more and more chores, until by the time their father disappeared, they toiled from dawn until long after nightfall, while their stepmother never lifted a finger.
Why didn't the fisherman and his babies live in the castle to protect them from the monster?
The castle was a dark, forbidding place on the top of a mountain. The fisherman had been told by his father that it had been built many ages ago by trolls who were still said to live there, and he did not have the 12 keys.
Did the wicked stepmother have the 12 keys?
She kept them buried in a secret place as long as the fisherman was around. But after he sailed away and did not come back, she had Nell and Harv dig them up again, along with a quantity of jewels and gold that she had brought with her from the land beyond. She bedecked herself with the gold and jewels, then opened up the iron gates of the dark castle and tricked Nell and Harv into going inside. As soon as they were in, she slammed the gates shut behind them and locked the 12 locks.
"When the sun goes down, the trolls will have you for a snack,"
she cackled.
"What's a troll?"
"A scary monster that lives in holes in the ground and comes out after dark." Nell started to cry. She slammed the book closed, ran to her bed, gathered her stuffed animals up in her arms, started chewing on her blanket, and cried for a while, considering the question of trolls. The book made a fluttering sound. Nell saw it opening in the corner of her eye and looked over cautiously, afraid she might see a picture of a troll. But instead, she saw two pictures. One was of Princess Nell sitting on the grass with four dolls gathered in her arms. Facing it was a picture of Nell surrounded by four creatures. A big dinosaur, a rabbit, a duck, and a woman in a purple dress with purple hair. The book said, "Would you like to hear the story of how Princess Nell made some friends in the dark castle where she least expected it, and how they killed all of the trolls and made it a safe place to live?"
"Yes,"
Nell said, and scooted across the floor until she was poised above the book. Judge Fang pays a visit to the Celestial Kingdom. Tea served in an ancient setting. A chance encounter with Dr. X. Judge Fang was not afflicted with the Westerner's inability to pronounce the name of the man known as Dr. X, unless a combined Cantonese-New York accent counted as a speech impediment. In his discussions with his trusted subordinates, he had fallen into the habit of calling him Dr. X anyway. He had never had cause to pronounce the name at all until recently. Judge Fang was district magistrate for the leased territories, which in turn were part of the Chinese Coastal Republic. Dr. X almost never left the boundaries of Old Shanghai, which was part of a separate district. More to the point, he stuck to a small but anfractuous subregion whose tendrils were seemingly ramified through every block and building of the ancient city. On the map, this region looked like the root system of a thousand-year-old dwarf tree. Its border must have been 100 kilometers long, even though it was contained within a couple of square kilometers. This region was not part of the Coastal Republic. It styled itself as the Middle Kingdom, a living vestige of Imperial China, prohibitively the oldest and greatest nation of the world. The tendrils went even farther than that. Judge Fang had known this for a long time. Many of the gang members running around the leased territories with Judge Fang's cane marks across their asses had connections on the mainland that could ultimately be traced back to Dr. X. It was rarely useful to dwell upon this fact. If it hadn't been Dr. X, it would have been someone else. Dr. X was unusually clever at taking advantage of the principle of grith, or right of refuge, which, in the modern usage, simply meant that Coastal Republic officials, like Judge Fang, could not enter the Celestial Kingdom and arrest someone like Dr. X. So usually when they bothered to trace a criminal's higher connections at all, they simply drew an arrow up the page to a single character consisting of a box with a vertical slash drawn down through the middle. The character meant middle, as in Middle Kingdom, though for Judge Fang it had come to mean simply trouble. At the house of the venerable and inscrutable colonel and other Judge Fang hangouts, the name of Dr. X had been pronounced more frequently in recent weeks. Dr. X had tried to bribe everyone on Judge Fang's hierarchy except for the judge himself. Of course, the overtures had been made by people whose connection with Dr. X was tenuous in the extreme, and had been so subtle that most of those approached had not even realized what was happening until days or weeks later they had suddenly sat up in bed exclaiming, "He was trying to bribe me! I must tell Judge Fang!" If not for Griff, this might have made for a merry and stimulating couple of decades, as Judge Fang matched his wits against those of the doctor, a worthy adversary at last, and a welcome break from smelly, larcenous, barbarian whelps. As it was, Dr. X's machinations were of purely abstract interest. But they were no less interesting for that, and many days, as Miss Powell proceeded through the familiar line of patter about sky eyes, heuristic mugging detection, and tagger aerostats, Judge Fang found his attention wandering across town to the ancient city, to the Hong of Dr. X. It was said that the doctor frequently took tea in the morning at an old tea house there, and so it was that one morning Judge Fang happened to drop in on the place. It had been built centuries ago in the center of a pond. Swarms of fire-colored fish hung just beneath the surface of the khaki water, glowing like latent coals, as Judge Fang and his assistants, Miss Pao and Chang, crossed the bridge. There was a Chinese belief that demons liked to travel only in straight lines. Hence, the bridge zigzagged no fewer than 9 times as it made its way to the center of the pond. The bridge was a demon filter, in other words, and the tea house demon-free, which seemed of only limited usefulness if it still hosted people like Dr. X. But for Judge Fang, raised in a city of long, straight avenues full of straight talkers, it was useful to be reminded that from the point of view of some people, including Dr. X, all of that straightness was suggestive of demonism. More natural and human was the ever-turning way, where you could never see round the next corner, and the overall plan could be understood only after lengthy meditation. The tea house itself was constructed of unfinished wood, aged to a nice gray. It looked rickety, but evidently wasn't. It was narrow and tall, 2 stories high, with a proud wing-like roof. One entered through a low, narrow door, built by and for the chronically undernourished. The interior had the ambience of a rustic cabin on a lake. Judge Fang had been here before in mufti, but today he had thrown a robe over his charcoal-gray pinstripe suit, a reasonably subtle brocade, funereal by comparison with what people used to wear in China. He also wore a black cap embroidered with a unicorn, which in most company would probably be lumped in with rainbows and elves, but here would be understood for what it was, an ancient symbol of acuity. Dr. X could be relied upon to get the message. The tea house staff had had plenty of time to realize he was coming as he negotiated the endless turns in the causeway. A manager of sorts and a couple of waitresses were arrayed before the door, bowing deeply as he approached. Judge Fang had been raised on Cheerios, burgers, and jumbo burritos, bulging with beans and meat. He was just a bit less than 2 meters in height. His beard was unusually thick, and he had been letting it grow out for a couple of years now, and his hair fell down past the tips of his shoulder blades. These elements, plus the hat and robe, and in combination with the power reposed in him by the state, gave him a certain presence of which he was well aware. He tried not to be overly satisfied with himself, as this would have gone against all Confucian precepts. On the other hand, Confucianism was all about hierarchy, and those who were in high positions were supposed to comport themselves with a certain dignity. Judge Fang could turn it on when he needed to. He used it now to get himself situated at the best table on the first floor, off in the corner, with a nice view out of the tiny old windows into the neighboring Ming-era garden. He was still in the coastal republic, in the middle of the 21st century, but he could have been in the Middle Kingdom of yore, and for all intents and purposes, he was. Chang and Miss Pao separated themselves from their master and requested a table on the second floor, up a narrow and alarming stairway, leaving Judge Fang in peace, whilst also making their presence forcibly known to Dr. X, who happened to be up there right now, as he always was at this time in the morning, sipping tea and chatting with his venerable homeboys. When Dr. X made his way down half an hour later, he was nonetheless delighted and surprised to see the moderately famous and widely respected Judge Fang sitting all by his lonesome staring out at the pond, its schools of fish flickering lambently. When he approached the table to tender his respects, Judge Fang invited him to take a seat, and after several minutes of sensitive negotiations over whether this would or would not be an unforgivable intrusion on the magistrate's privacy, Dr. X finally, gratefully, reluctantly, respectfully, took a seat. There was lengthy discourse between the two men on which of them was more honored to be in the company of the other, followed by exhaustive discussion on the relative merits of the different teas offered by the proprietors, whether the leaves were best picked in early or late April, whether the brewing water should be violently boiling, as the pathetic Guelos always did it, or limited to 80 degrees Celsius. Eventually, Dr. X got around to complimenting Judge Fang on his cap, especially on the embroidery work. This meant that he had noticed the unicorn and understood its message, which was that Judge Fang had seen through all his efforts at bribery. Not long afterward, Miss Pao came down and regretfully informed the judge that his presence was urgently required at a crime scene in the leased territories. To spare Judge Fang the embarrassment of having to cut short the conversation, Dr. X was approached moments later by one of his staff, who whispered something into his ear. The doctor apologized for having to take his leave, and the two men then got into a very genteel argument over which one of them was being more inexcusably rude, and then over which would precede the other across the bridge. Judge Fang ended up going first, because his duties were deemed more pressing, and thus ended the first meeting between the judge and Dr. X. The judge was quite happy. It had all gone just as planned. Hackworth receives an unexpected visit from Inspector Chang. Mrs. Hull had to shake the flour out of her apron to answer the door. Hackworth, working in his study, assumed it was a mere delivery, until she appeared in his doorway, harumphing lightly,
holding a salver with a single card centered on it. Lieutenant Chang. His organization was called, in traditional Chinese general to specific order, China Coastal, Republic Shanghai, New Chuzan, Leased Territories, District Magistrate Office.
What does he want?
To give your app back.
Send him in, Hackworth said, startled.
Mrs. Hull dawdled significantly. Hackworth glanced into a mirror and saw himself reaching for his throat, checking the knot on his necktie. His smoking jacket was hanging loose, and he wrapped it tight and retied the sash. Then he went to the parlor. Mrs. Hull led Lieutenant Chang into the parlor. He was a burly, ungainly fellow with a short buzz cut. Hackworth's top hat, looking rather ill-used, could be seen indistinctly through a large plastic bag clenched in his hand.
"Lieutenant Chang," Mrs. Hull announced, and Chang bowed at Hackworth, smiling a bit more than seemed warranted.
Hackworth bowed back.
"Lieutenant Chang,
I will not disturb you for long, I promise," Chang said in clear but unrefined English. "During an investigation, details not relevant here, we got this from a suspect. It is marked your property. Much the worse for wear. Please accept it."
"Well done, Lieutenant," said Hackworth, receiving the bag and holding it up to the light. "I did not expect to see it again, even in such a battered condition."
"Well, these boys do not have respect for a good hat, I am afraid," said Lieutenant Chang.
Hackworth paused, not knowing what one was supposed to say at this point. Chang just stood there, seeming more at ease in Hackworth's parlor than Hackworth was. The first exchange had been simple, but now the east-west curtain fell between them like a rusty cleaver. Was this part of some official procedure? Was it a solicitation for a tip? Or just Mr. Chang being a nice guy? When in doubt, end the visit sooner rather than later.
"Well," said Hackworth, "I don't know and don't care what you arrested him for, but I commend you for having done so."
Lieutenant Chang did not get the hint and realize it was time to leave. On the contrary, he seemed just a bit perplexed now, where before everything had been so simple.
"I cannot help being curious," Chang said. "What gave you the idea that anyone had been arrested?"
Hackworth felt a spear pass through his heart.
"You're a police lieutenant holding what appears to be an evidence bag," he said. "The implication is clear."
Lieutenant Chang looked at the bag, laboriously perplexed.
"Evidence? It is just a shopping bag to protect your hat from the rain, and I am not here in my official capacity."
Another spear, at right angles to the first one.
"Though," Chang continued, "if some criminal activity has taken place of which I was not made aware, perhaps I should recharacterize this visit."
Spear number three. Now Hackworth's pounding heart sat at the origin of a bloody coordinate system plotted by Lieutenant Chang, conveniently pinned and exposed for thorough examination. Chang's English was getting better all the time, and Hackworth was beginning to think that he was one of those Shanghainese who had spent much of his life in Vancouver, New York, or London.
"I had assumed that the gentleman's hat had simply been misplaced or perhaps blown off by a gust of wind. Now you say criminals were involved."
Chang looked as though he had never, to this day, suspected the existence of criminals in the leased territories. Then shock was transcended by wonder as he segued none too subtly into the next phase of the trap.
"It was not important," Hackworth said, trying to derail Chang's relentless train of thought, sensing that he and his family were tied to the tracks.
Chang ignored him, as if so exhilarated by the workings of his mind that he could not be distracted.
"Mr. Hackworth, you have given me an idea. I have been trying to solve a difficult case, a mugging that took place a few days ago. The victim was an unidentified Atlantan gentleman."
"Don't you have tagmites for that kind of thing?"
"Oh," Lieutenant Chang said, sounding rather downhearted. "Tagmites are not very reliable. The perpetrators took certain precautions to prevent the mites from attaching. Of course, several mites attached themselves to the victim. But before we could track him, he made his way to New Atlantis Clave, where your superb immune system destroyed those mites. So his identity has remained a mystery." Chang reached into his breast pocket and pulled out a folded sheet of paper.
"Mr. Hackworth, please tell me whether you recognize any of the figures in this clip."
"I'm actually rather busy," Hackworth said, but Chang unfolded the paper in front of him and gave it a command in Shanghainese. Initially, the page was covered with static Chinese characters. Then a large panel in the middle opened up and began to play back a cine feed. Watching himself getting mugged was one of the most astonishing things Hackworth had ever seen. He could not stop watching it. The feed went to slow motion, and then out came the book. Tears came to Hackworth's eyes, and he made an effort not to blink lest he dislodge them. Not that it really mattered, since Lieutenant Chang was standing rather close to him and could no doubt see everything. Chang was shaking his head in wonderment.
"So it was you, Mr. Hackworth. I had not made the connection. So many nice things and such a vicious beating. You have been the victim of a very serious crime."
Hackworth could not speak and had nothing to say anyway.
"It is striking to me," Chang continued, "that you did not bother to report this serious crime to the magistrate. For some time now, we have been reviewing this tape, wondering why the victim, a respectable gentleman, did not step forward to assist us with our inquiries."
"So much effort wasted," Chang fretted. Then he brightened up. "But it's all water under the bridge, I suppose. We have one or two of the gang in custody on an unrelated crime, and now I can charge them with your mugging as well. Of course, we will require your testimony."
"Of course."
"The items that were taken from you?"
"You saw it."
"Yes. A watch chain with various items, a fountain pen, and..."
"That's it." Chang seemed just a bit nonplussed, but more than that, he seemed deeply satisfied, suffused by a newly generous spirit.
"The book does not even bear mentioning?"
"Not really."
"It looked like an antique of some sort. Quite valuable, no?"
"A fake. That sort of thing is popular with us. A way to build an impressive-seeming library without going broke."
"Ah, that explains it," said Mr. Chang, growing more satisfied by the minute.
If Hackworth provided him any more reassurance on the matter of the book, he would no doubt curl up on the sofa and fall asleep.
"Still, I should mention the book in my official report, which will be shared with New Atlantis authorities, as the victim in this case belonged to that file."
"Don't," said Hackworth, finally turning to look Chang in the eye for the first time. "Don't mention it."
I cannot imagine your motive for saying this," Chang said. "But I have little leeway in the matter. We are closely monitored by our supervisors."
"Perhaps you could simply explain my feelings to your supervisor." Lieutenant Chang received this suggestion with a look of wild surmise.
"Mr. Hackworth, you are a very clever fellow, as I already gathered from your demanding and very responsible position. But I am ashamed to tell you that your excellently devious plan may not work. My supervisor is a cruel taskmaster with no regard for human feelings. To be quite frank, and I tell you this in all confidence, he is not entirely without ethical blemishes."
"Ah," Hackworth said. "So, if I am following you..."
"Oh no, Mr. Hackworth, it is I who am following you."
"The appeal to sympathy won't work, and we will have to sway him using another strategy, perhaps related to this ethical blind spot."
"That is an approach that had not occurred to me."
"Perhaps you should do some thinking, or even some research as to what level and type of inducement might be required," Hackworth said, suddenly walking toward the exit. Lieutenant Chang followed him. Hackworth hauled his front door open and allowed Chang to retrieve his own hat and umbrella from the rack. "Then simply get back to me, and spell it out as plainly and simply as you can manage. Good night, Lieutenant Chang." As he rode his bicycle toward the gate on his way back to the leased territories, Chang was exultant over the success of tonight's research. Of course, neither he nor Judge Fang was interested in extracting bribes from this Hackworth, but Hackworth's willingness to pay served as proof that the book did, in fact, embody stolen intellectual property. But then he bridled his emotions, remembering the words of the philosopher Tsang to Yang Fu upon the latter's appointment to chief criminal judge. The rulers have failed in their duties, and the people consequently have been disorganized for a long time. When you have found out the truth of any accusation, be grieved for and pity them, and do not feel joy at your own ability. Not that Chang's abilities had even been tested this evening. Nothing could be easier than getting the New Atlantans to believe that Chinese police were corrupt.